Hello and welcome to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. For this episode, I'll be covering the globalist agenda, in particular, banking. Now, before I get started, I'd like to make a few announcements and talk about some feedback I received. As of this recording, I was just checking my stats, and this podcast has now been downloaded over 25,000 times. I thought this was very impressive. I didn't expect that many downloads. It's kind of nice to see, and I'm glad people are enjoying this. And also, for other announcements, I was a guest on the Conspiracy Skeptic podcast with Carl Maimer. We did a year in review type show. I did one earlier before I had this podcast, and had a lot of fun. It was really interesting. Carl's a great guy, and if you haven't heard his podcast, I've got a link on my homepage at mikebowler.com, and be sure to check out the Conspiracy Skeptic podcast. He also does a one that I really like is Ask a Canadian. Carl does a really great job. I really get a kick out of that particular podcast. And then I've also been getting some really excellent feedback. I got one from Donovan, who likes the podcast, and he recommended something for the future. So I'm hoping to, hopefully, maybe within the next one or two after this one, I'll have that podcast up, or have that topic up. And then James sent a real nice email. He did leave a pretty long email. I won't get into too much of it. Would like to say, though, I really like it. What was said in the email was, really good. I mean, I definitely agree with what was said in the email, though I'm still kind of going through it a little bit. I've been dealing with a flu bug. I'm just finally back to pretty much normal, so I'm trying to crank out this episode. So, and I'll try to go through this again with a clearer head. But I definitely have gotten a lot of real positive feedback, and so I think I'm onto something here, and hopefully you folks have been enjoying this. So if it's possible, I would love to see my rating on iTunes go up a little bit. So if you find time or a chance or the ability, if you can give me a 5-star review, it would be very helpful. I just like to see some of the earlier, when I first got started and had some issues with sound quality, that seemed to be the main issue with some of the early 1-star reviews. So if you could, and if you don't mind, it would be nice to try to offset some of those 1-stars with some 5-stars. So that would be very, very helpful. Also, I've set up a Facebook page for this podcast. So if you're interested, it's mostly mainly the same postings I do for my Twitter account, and I've got everything going over to G+. So I've got pages on Facebook, A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. I got the same thing on G+, plus my Twitter, which again all the links could be found on my homepage. So if you want to follow those, that would, you know, again, it'd be mostly the same announcements you'll see. If you already subscribe to one, you'll get the same messages on the other three. So no real need to overload yourselves with extra alerts. It'll all be the same stuff. I'm definitely getting some extra friends on Facebook. On the Facebook page, G+ isn't going too far, but it's there if you're interested. And again, I'd like to thank everybody for listening, and hopefully for this year it'll be getting much better. Thanks. Now, this episode's going to be more on the globalist agenda, focusing primarily on banking. And before I get started, I'd like to say that this particular topic kind of kicked my butt a little bit. There's a lot to banking that kind of plays into why there is this conspiracy, or at least the globalists, these people believe in a globalist agenda, and that particular conspiracy, why probably better will help explain a lot of the problems. So for this one, I'm going to try to do my best. Might have to treat this one as a kind of a, not so much an overview, but a pretty good, solid overview. Now the idea, again, much of this belief that the banks are trying to take over the world is, again, based a lot out of the Protocols of the Learned and Elders of Zion. Again, one of the line items is to take control of money, and the best way to do that is through banking. Not that this was a very new concept. Actually, in many cases, in the early 1800s, people were accusing Freemasons as being trying to control banks, and actually been accused of manipulating the Second Federal Bank, which was the second attempt for the United States to create a central bank. But really, our current conspiracy centers around the Jews controlling the banks. Again, this, of course, had been changed from Jewish banking to international banking to globalist agenda. Though there's a few that still, and actually what makes the banking conspiracies neat is that it seems almost interchangeable between a globalist agenda, or in some cases people just believe that it's just banks that are the problems and they're being controlled through nefarious means. So to best understand what's going on and why this is a conspiracy, I look to guys like G. Edward Griffin, who wrote about the Federal Reserve and how it's illegal and all that kind of stuff. You got Alex Jones, who kind of parrots Griffin's book, Griffin's Beliefs. And, of course, again, I point to David Icke. He also believes that the world elite is trying to control the banks, or controls the banks, again, for much of the same reasons that have been laid out before, that this is the Jews taking over the world. In Icke's case, it's the alien reptiles that are trying to take over the world or control the world. And even it goes even further, and I've been aware of a guy called Jordan Maxwell. He is a astrotheologist, or that's what he calls himself, or people call him, but he's believes that everything originates from the worship of the sun, i.e. Satan. And again, banks, the way laws are worded and stuff like that, and he really makes very little sense, but he tries to use the wordings of the laws and stuff like that to represent that we owe our money to Satan. And that's probably fairly close. I'll be looking into him more and probably doing some shows about that. But basically, the goal here is that, and at least the as far as the agenda goes, to try to have total control over the banks. The banks create debt, and makes us go into debt to them, thus somehow controlling us and how we think and act and all that kind of stuff. And oddly enough, I found some truths, but it's not exactly what these guys claim it to be. Now, banks have always had a role and they had basically three functions. One, to accept deposits. That is simply, I have some money, I could put it in the bank, and that becomes an investment. The bank pays me an interest rate. The bank then takes that money that I lend them and lend it to someone else. Of course, at a higher interest rate, so I get paid, my money that's in there gets, I get money in interest. The bank makes money from the interest on the loan, and life is good until, you know, and then when the loan's paid off, you know, cycle complete. But one of the third roles has been to actually create money. Now, this money creation isn't like what a lot of people would like you to believe. There's a video on YouTube called Money is Debt, and its basic premise is that when you take out a loan, the bank will take part of its money, the deposit, and along with as part of building the loan, will create money to flesh out the money being borrowed. All the bank has to do then is, you know, mark a ledger, loan to so-and-so. So-and-so will pay that to the person that he's buying the house or the car or whatever he's buying. He puts that money in his account, and magically money just appeared out of nowhere. Now, it doesn't work this way to a degree. What the banks used to do, and I'm not only going to refer to the U.S. banks, I'm not going to get into European banking. I don't know what their rules are. I'm more familiar with the American rules, is that I could deposit that money into a bank, collect interest, or I could take gold, silver, something along that lines, basically specie currency, take it to a bank, they give me, and I could trade that for bank certificates. Now, this was actually an actual function of the bank, where I could take, you know, whatever sum of gold, silver, whatever hard currency, the bank would give me certificates where I could pay out smaller amounts. I mean, if I got a 10-pound nugget, I can't just shave off a little bit, you know, so it was always easier to take the big, you know, these larger sums, and you could create this script and use that to pay your bills, your buy whatever you needed to buy. And that's what the banks did. And of course, that script basically it's not fiat currency, it was used as a currency. You can buy and sell whatever you wanted with it. You can also trade it for other script or cash it back in and get your gold back out. Again, this is what the banks did until we went off the gold standard. Now, there's always been, within the United States, a animosity towards central banking. Our first two attempts at a central bank, the first federal bank and the second federal bank, weren't abolished. They were just literally their charters were never renewed. It wouldn't be until 1913 with the Federal Reserve Act that created our Federal Reserve System, which in effect became our central bank. Now, like I said, there was this common argument. It actually began with Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson was opposed to central banking because that, and again, his arguments are kind of confusing because it almost sounds like he's talking about the state banks or the commercial banks that were in existence already, that it could create and force people into debt, and argued that it worked against the farmer. Central banking seems, in his mind, favored manufacturing. So that would actually, a central bank would benefit the northern states who had timber industries, shipbuilding industries, and such. Whereas under the a central bank that Hamilton's argument was that it could help alleviate depressions and recessions by taking its money, and when a bank was in trouble, infused it with the additional cash, then when the crisis was over, pay back that particular, you know, the cash back to the central bank. And that was probably one of his primary arguments. There's others, but this was the view. So when the move to create the Federal Reserve, many of those same arguments were coming up, mostly in most cases, so as the United States began to try to create a Federal Reserve, or went to create the Federal Reserve System, many of these same arguments were coming up. So our Federal Reserve was actually structured a little differently, where actually you have an overview committee managing regional banks or regional Federal Reserve banks that would then, banks within those regions would have to buy shares in the Federal Reserve if they wished to join. Now again, the rules at the time that the Federal Reserve was created, you didn't have to join the Federal Reserve. You could still go about printing your own currency if necessary. There was no requirements unless you wanted to have deposit insurance available to your customers. So a handful did join the Federal Reserve early on, and through the system of buying shares in the Federal Reserve, the local state banks actually became extensions and had ownership of the Federal Reserve. Contrary to, again, many of the conspiracy people who argue that the Federal Reserve is owned by private banks. Kind of, I guess, true, but there are so many private banks that there's no one owner of our Federal Reserve. And again, another thing that most of the conspiracy people fail to tell anyone is that all the commissioners, the overall committee that runs the Federal Reserve, and then the individual committees that run each regional, have to be appointed by Congress. So Congress does still have control over the Federal Reserve, whether these people believe it or not. Now, the role of the Federal Reserve was set up to be to work like a stopgap, where, again, if a particular region was having economic problems, the Federal Reserve could step in, infuse cash into those particular banks that are having trouble, or the particular region that might be having trouble, drawing funds from healthier regions. And again, when the crisis was over, that money would end up going back to the individual or the regional Federal Reserves. And, of course, one of the important parts was for the Federal Reserves in these regions to be monitoring economic activity in those particular regions, so they could try to anticipate financial or economic issues that may be starting, or at least predicted enough that they could produce whatever cash or have cash available to deal with economic problems within a town or a region or such. So, and again, now in this early stage between its inception in 1913 to 1933 with the banking reform, the U.S. currency was still redeemable in gold. So to try to come up with a conclusion for this particular conspiracy, I have to admit that this particular subject kind of kicked my butt. And actually, it reflects I'm kind of late on putting this podcast out, because I've been trying to figure out a few things. One, is there a problem? Is there really a problem with the banks? Is there a problem with the economy? is there, that, or at least how we interpret the economy, and, or is this just the, just a general repeat of similar themes? And in a way, I find that in some cases it is a repeat of the common themes. See, in many cases, some of these arguments even go back even before the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion and the Jewish, this Jewish conspiracy. It actually goes further back into early Freemasonry in the United States, roughly about the 1840s, where they believed that the Freemasons were doing what they then turned, they eventually turned on the Jews and blamed them instead of Freemasons. Of course, sometimes it seems like in some cases the conspiracy people like to mix the two, that they'll use Judaism as a and Freemasonry kind of interchangeably. And then when I started trying to figure out economics, and admittedly I'm not formally trained in economics. I'm kind of self-teaching myself at this point, and in a way, and from what I'm beginning to discover that trying to understand an economic system, or try to understand some of the schools of thought, whether it's Keynesian, Austrian school, Swedish school of economics, I began to realize that, and at least my initial impressions are that trying to understand an economic system takes in so many variables, and not just physically supply and demand calculations, or interest rate determinations, money supply, but it's also a variable in the sense that we're dealing with humans, human interactions, what their perception is of future events. You can almost calculate out that it, somewhat into the future, and you could probably do that fairly reasonably accurate. But when you look at what's happening in the future, you can make decision. You'll make decisions that could adversely affect the that future results, and that's what happens. Like with in the stock market, you tell them inflation's up 0.5%. Well, what does that mean? It means something different to different people. It may mean that your stock is going to go up. It may mean your stock's going to go down. And, of course, you're reacting to that information. So trying to, just even the concept of economics is almost frustrating, if anything. Definitely very complex, and trying to get a good handle on it so I could speak a little bit more authoritatively. And then trying to understand how banks were supposed to work. Again, we're still dealing with some of the same situations. I mean, we're dealing with, banking is sort of a subset of an economy, but they're subject to regulations or deregulations. And actually, there's an interesting book on, it's actually the history of U.S. banking and the effects of regulation. This particular author seems to believe that by regulating banks creates more problems than they solve. And it was an interesting book, and really enlightening. So going through all that, I realized that anything with money, how money works in our current economic system, our current, within the capitalist system, is so complex that a layperson is going to have one hell of a time trying to figure out what's really going on, and really trying to understand why, just trying to understand some of even the basic concepts. What is debt? What is a loan? What is deposit? All these things are, in a way, you could probably find out or figure out, but to the average person who may only rent a house, they have no concept of what a mortgage may be all about. And when they go in to buy their first house, I mean, they're bombarded with all sorts of things. I remember when I bought my first house, all the questions and every piece of paper you had to sign. I mean, it was just incredible what had to come together to get a mortgage together. So it kind of dawned on me that with this confusion, it really makes it easier for guys like Diego Griffin, Alex Jones, even Ron Paul, who's been very vocal against the Federal Reserve. He wants to bring back a gold standard and get the government out of private business. It makes sense to some people because they may have had bad experiences with their bank or with the government. And, you know, people in some cases, I mean, sometimes we want change. Apparently, that's why we elected Barack Obama as our president, because he was supposed to bring, he's supposed to, and he's brought change. He's supposed to bring change, or he has brought change, and he's supposed to bring change. But there's this level of confusion of what's really going on, and guys like, especially Alex Jones, and he's talking about all sorts of crazy stuff, and so your Joe Sixpacks out there who trying to understand what's going on, they're bombarded with all this. So, with all this confusion, it allows for the various theories and hypotheses to creep in and say, hey, the problem is the Federal Reserve. They do this. This is a problem. And that's why I think this particular conspiracy stays alive. And again, and this is one of the other problems of dealing with dealing with conspiracies based on a historical basis, or those that hold a more of a historical than a scientific basis, is that we're dealing with opinions, and opinions vary. I mean, my opinion is probably as valid as Alex Jones's is, and the thing would be, though, that I have to be, I can prove that the problem, and especially like with this our current recession, I mean, clearly was caused by the housing boom, or that particular housing bubble bursting, usually. And we've seen similar bubble bursts before the .com. We saw a slight recession after the .coms collapsed. So, and actually, I mean, we've seen, everyone saw the bubble. Everyone but the people that were in it, or that's that statement. And so, to kind of wrap this up a little bit, as far as this globalist agenda goes, and how they look at banking, they seem to be more focused on central banking, international banking, which usually, for some, international banking represents Jewish banking. That seems to be the common thread here. So, and relying upon the confusion, how an economy works, all the different, like I said, a lot of the variables that have come in is really fairly confusing, even for those experts who were supposed to be watching all this, watchdogging our economy. So, to try to wrap this up a little bit, trying to understand this banking conspiracy and this globalist agenda as it relates, as far as those who are promoting this globalist agenda, guys like Griffin, Jones, and such, they're relying upon our basic confusion of how an economy works, that with this confusion, they can say, well, it's because, the Rothschilds are doing this and the Rockefellers are doing that, and this is all by design, it's all engineered, this is all automatic, we're on an automatic pilot to bankruptcy. They're going to destroy the United States banking, and we'll be out of our money, and then will happily go into our FEMA camps and to be exterminated. And this is all by design. And that's what they keep saying, and that's what they believe. And they'll use, they've used the recession, the current, our current recession we're in, that they intentionally inflated house prices in California. And then when those collapsed, that created the problem. And it's all by design, because the government did this and the mortgage companies did that and all that kind of fun stuff, when in reality, the California bubble apparently was, yes, it was government-backed. Not only did the federal government provided money for low-income housing or low-income mortgages, California required all the banks to provide low-income mortgages. And that created this really, actually kind of a pretty interesting, what it created was this almost frenzied buying and selling of property. And poor people were getting rich in California by just buying a house and then sit on it for 5 years, and they could sell it for, you know, an extra $100,000 or extra $200,000, and they kept trying to keep that going. And eventually that all fell apart, but it was fun while it lasted. This had nothing really to do, I mean, it was partially supported by the government, but individuals took advantage of the system. And that's probably one of the things I've noticed. And when we start talking about, and I'll probably go back to my commerce and industry show, because what you'll see there, what I've actually started to discover, was that it's not so much the rules that are in place, it's the people that are interpreting and enacting the rules, or those who bend the rules, break the rules. So, this whole thing is kind of maybe these globalists are right, that we create these bubbles and we burst them as we please. But really, it's more taking a highly variable situation, an economy where, money in, money out, money does this and this and this, and it'll do this dependent on, and it could be subject to weather when we talk about food prices, or it might vary on, if there's a strike, a steel worker strike, so no steel to Detroit to make cars, and so car prices go up and all that kind of stuff, those variables. And then you have those who are trying to capitalize on those variables. And so what you have is this really almost, it's almost like a monster, multi-tentacle monster that's trying to, trying to maintain some control, but it's not going to, it's really not going to happen. And again, the Joneses and the Griffins and the Ikes, they've all capitalized upon this insanity now. And probably for maybe one last point, so I almost have to conclude that even though there are some realities here, that the economy is a fluid, it's almost like a living, breathing creature, it almost seems counter to the fact that it can be controlled by a small handful of bankers or Congress critters or, parliamentarians or whoever can, whoever makes rules, that these people can control that enough to take all that money and leave us all broke. And again, through the bankrupt us, so we go in happily into the FEMA camps to be exterminated. Sorry, I keep using that term, but that seems to be the end game that seems to be promoted by globalist agenda types, that we're supposed to then get wiped out so these guys can live happily high on the hog with all this money and just a few handful of people to wait on them hand and foot and run their little businesses instead of their big, huge corporations. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebohler.com. That's MikeBohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebohler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebohler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Tsarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.